We're very pleased to host this luncheon for the Middle East Forum, and especially because Andrew McCarthy is here as our noted speaker. I assume all of you are know something about the Middle East Forum. It's a special, really valuable organization for people who believe in truth in the world, and particularly in Middle Eastern affairs. It's an organization that's got a very small budget, and with that budget, I think, leverages it tremendously with a small staff and has a lot of activities and really brings a lot of information against an onslaught of information that's coming from very well-financed organizations in the Middle East. It says here that the mission of the Middle East Forum is to define and promote American interests in the Middle East and help the United States defend itself at home. Hallmarks of mission include fighting radical Islam rather than terrorism, supporting democracy, and working for Palestinian acceptance of Israel. That's a tall order. They have, Middle East Forum has, a quarterly publication that's very informative. They have Campus Watch, which I look at the website and see. It exposes extremism and bias in Middle Eastern studies. If anybody looks at this, they'll be incredulous to the extent of bias, anti-Semitism, really, to put it bluntly, existing on our college campuses, some of the best universities, some of the not so great universities. Islamist Watch, which combats nonviolent radical Islamic activities, and the Legal Project, which provides legal aid for anti-Islamist researchers and activists in danger of having their free speech curtailed. One of the programs that the radical Islamists have is if someone says something negative about them or about things that they believe in or their attempts maybe to introduce Sharia into law in Western societies, they'll sue this person for slander or whatever. The person being sued, of course, has a lot of legal expenses, and put even if they're 100% right and have a case that they could win, the legal process could be crushing. So the purpose of the Legal Project is to assist people like this with legal help with, am I explaining it properly? And it's really, it's valuable, and it's very, very important. And of course, the lecture series goes on and on. I don't want to take too much of the time because this is really for Andrew McCarthy. He's written a book, Willful Blindness. I just looked at the flyleaf. I mean, it's really a phenomenal book. And no use me telling you about it. Andrew McCarthy is here, and he's a former U.S. attorney. He's a very articulate man, brilliant man. He's here in the Southern District, and we're very happy to welcome him.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here, particularly because, as Daniel was reminding me when I got here, one of the first places that I actually ever gave a talk about radical Islam, at least our experience with it from the front lines at the Justice Department, was the Middle East Forum. And in fact, the first person who published me was Daniel. In the Middle East Quarterly back in 1996, a dozen years ago. And I think that's noteworthy because the article I wrote at the time was called Prosecuting the New York Sheikh. And then, you know, here we are 12 years later, and I wrote a book essentially about prosecuting the New York Sheikh, which is, I think, kind of a measure of the fact that either I can't write anything else or we haven't learned anything else. I hope it's the latter, although that doesn't make us shouldn't make us feel much better. The book, and let me spend a few minutes talking about it and trying to explain what it's about and why I wrote it. The main reason I wrote this book, which is a book I never ever wanted to write, is precisely because we're more than a dozen years down the road, and we're actually still talking about and arguing about, and I think rightfully worrying about, the very things that were of great concern to us in the mid, the early to mid 1990s, except that the threat has gotten worse. And from my perspective, especially 7 years out from 9/11, our apprehension about it has also gotten less mindful and less committed. I see us going backwards and fast approaching what I would call a September 10th mentality, where we'll be right back to where we were before the 9/11 attacks, which is really an extraordinary development if you think about how devastating those attacks were at the time that they occurred. I didn't want to write the book because a lot of it is personal, a lot of it is painful. It requires, if you're going to do it honestly, being honest about mistakes that we made, including mistakes that I made. I also feel strongly that people who work in the field of national security in particular are called on to make a lot of gut-wrenching decisions. As we were in the mid-90s, and as has been the case ever since then. And I really thought that to the extent that we had to wrestle with those things in the early 90s, I was always confident that we went in the room, there wasn't somebody there writing it all down. And when you have a feeling like somebody's writing it all down and you're going to read it on the front page of the New York Times or in a tell-all memoir someday, I think that's a fast ticket to getting very bad advice, because people will tend to just say the safe, politically correct thing under circumstances where, when we're dealing with what is really a novel type of threat to our national security, what I think you want out of the people who are your national security experts are their most imaginative, most well thought out, most unrestrained, best analyses of what the problems that we confront are. And I don't think you want to have a situation where people are afraid to say things they really think because of the way they'll be reported afterwards. And for that reason, I didn't write this book for a very long time, despite the fact that I think we were really again and again making the same mistakes again and again. And I ultimately decided that while I didn't want to write something that's a tell-all book, and I think, you know, those of you who have read it or will read it can judge for yourselves, but I don't think the nature of the book is that. I think it is important to try to relate what we saw and what we were confronted with from a perspective that is unusual in the glut of reporting that's been done about terrorism, particularly since 9/11. I don't know that there are any other reports from people who were actually on what passed for the front lines of America's response to radical Islam back in 1993, which I'm convinced is actually the declaration of war by radical Islam against the United States. It's the announcement by them to us that we could be struck, we had been struck, in the financial heart of the West. And you know, the odd and excruciating thing is, at the time that the attack happened, they warned us that the World Trade Center, for example, would continue to be one of their targets. It was, the writing was on the wall and clear as a bell back in 1993, and for whatever reason, we didn't see it, or at least we didn't want to see it, and therefore wouldn't see it, and that's what the book is about. I try to treat three main themes in the book, and I guess I'd wrap them up as follows. The first is that a foreign threat to national security is fundamentally a political issue of self-defense. It's not a legal issue of enforcing the criminal law. And if you try to legalize or turn into litigation problems your national security challenges, that is a prescription for a suicidal result. And I think that's exactly what we did in the 1990s. We had the very suicidal result that one would expect if you think about what the differences in assumptions are between your national defense challenges and your what goes on in the legal system. The second theme of the book is that there were a variety of reasons to see why we were under a perilous threat by the radical Islamists, and we refused to take them seriously for whatever reason. After these attacks happened, and I'm going to talk about the wave of attacks through the 90s, there were very clear signs that this was a very severe problem. Law enforcement was aware of them, and for a variety of reasons, we looked the other way. And I think that's a severe problem because here we are 7 years after 9/11, and it's almost become government policy to look the other way, to the point where we now have a language purge brought to us by the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security, which encourages us at this point not to speak about jihad, not to talk about such code words as Islamofascism, Mujahideen. This is a campaign to deny a fact that I think has to register and should long ago have registered, and that is that this is a wave of terrorist violence which is driven by a particular ideology that has its roots in Islam. And that is just an undeniable fact. It's not something that's the wave of violence that we have dealt with may be exacerbated by the problem of the moment. It may be exacerbated by a lack of democracy or poverty in parts of the world, illiteracy in parts of the world, or whatever cause it is that we're picking this week to blame it on. But what drives this more than anything else is a interpretation of Islam. And it is not a fringe interpretation of Islam. I think we'd like to comfort ourselves in thinking that, and this certainly was the government's, certainly the government's approach in 93 and has been the government's approach ever since, that there's just this fringe handful of maniacs out there who are involved in violence. And if we could just neutralize all of them, everything else would be fine. And we wouldn't need to worry about the tens of millions, if not more, of people who are adherents to the ideology that actually drives Islamic terror. So that is the second theme of the book. And the third, which I think follows on that, is that you can't take the Islam out of Islamic terror. Try as we might, and we continue to do. I have a couple of incidents that I talk about in the book, which I think make this point better than I could by dilating on in an abstract way. We needed to prepare for the possibility that the blind sheikh, who was our lead defendant, Omar Abdulrahman, he was a blind Islamic cleric at the time in about his mid-50s, responsible for the fatwa that authorized the murder of President Sadat in Egypt, the emir of a brutal terrorist organization in Egypt called Gamat al-Islamiyya, the Islamic group, and he had moved by then to the New York area where he had set up shop and basically created the structure and the recruitment of the terrorist cell, which began operating in the New York, New Jersey metropolitan area in the late 1980s. And much of our case was directed at him. We prosecuted him in the the trial was 1995 for seditious conspiracy, which was basically a terrorist conspiracy against the United States that involved both the World Trade Center bombing and a secondary plot to bomb New York City landmarks, the Lincoln and Holland tunnels, the FBI's lower Manhattan headquarters at the Javits Building, and the UN complex on the east side. Our evidence against him, I thought, was in parts slippery, but for the most part compelling, particularly the fact that we got him on tape recommending to his underlings that they find a plan to bomb an American military installation. And I talk in the book about the informant's performance in getting that tape, which was a fairly daring incident. But to move to what I began to talk about, we had to anticipate that he might take the stand. As it turned out, he did not take the stand in his trial. But there was every reason to think that he might have. So I had to, get prepared potentially to cross-examine him. And what I thought was, and my learning curve about radical Islam back then was a lot different from what it is now, but I thought that if what we were saying as a government was true, if what we were dealing with were just a fringe group of extremists who were lying about what the government freely called the true Islam, then surely there would be two or three places where I could catch him in lies about Islamic doctrine. I was not foolish enough to think that an Irish Catholic from the Bronx could get into a theology argument with a doctor of Islamic jurisprudence graduated from Al-Azhar University. But I did think that if what we were saying was true, there had to be a couple of places where I could nail him, where I could say, you said this, but the doctrine says that. We had hundreds of hours of tape-recorded conversations, speeches he had given. He had written a book, which was basically derived out of his defense when he was prosecuted in connection with the Sadat murder. So we had mounds and mounds of material to work with and lots of time to work with it. There were probably about a year and a half between the time we arrested people and the time that we finally went to trial. We went through all that stuff with a fine tooth comb, and every place he said, the Quran says this, the Quran said that. Every place he said the Hadith say this, that's exactly what they said. There wasn't a single place where he said that the written doctrine of Islam was X, where we could prove or show that he was wrong. Now, I want to be clear. Islamic doctrine says a lot of things, and there are many things that he didn't dwell on. There are less forcible, less violent interpretations of Islam. I don't want to pretend that Islam is a monolith. But, and this is a big but, the ideology that he was not only an adherent of, but is a thinker in, and was an inspiring thinker in, such that he was able to recruit people to the cause, is one that has a very rich pedigree. It's 14 centuries old. It has commanded the allegiance of the old and the young, the educated and the uneducated, the rich and the poor. And people have been willing to die for it throughout history, not just modern history. And I think in terms of the peril to ourselves, we do ourselves no good by underestimating what it is that we deal with. It is said, estimated that the Islamic world or the number of Muslims in the world is as much as perhaps 1.4 billion, maybe more, maybe less. I'm not for a moment suggesting that you have tens of millions of people who are willing to blow up buildings or drive jumbo jets into skyscrapers, but you have a healthy portion who are too healthy for our security. I mean, even if it's a very small percentage of that number who follow this particular ideology, you're talking about at least tens of thousands of people. And moreover, there are many, many people who share the ideology, who want to see it succeed, who would not take the step to become terrorists, but absolutely share what the ultimate goals are. And that is the reason that we not only have to be concerned about the hard jihad, which is basically what I talk about in the book, but what others have called the stealth jihad, the soft jihad, the encroachment of Sharia through our institutions and in our law. That was one experience with the blind sheikh. Let me just quickly mention another one. We had a very lengthy defense case in the trial. Much longer than not only the average defense case, much longer than the average criminal trial. The defense case in our case actually went on for 2.5 months out of the 9-month trial. And in the course of the defense case, a number of people came in to testify who were self-described moderate Muslims. And having observed them closely and had to cross-examine a number of them, I can assure you that they were absolutely, authentically moderate people. They would never get involved in terrorist acts, and I don't even think they shared the terrorist ideology to the extent that they may have thought about it much at all. But the frightening thing was, every now and then, while these people were on the stand, a question about Islamic doctrine would come up. And on at least three different occasions, these moderate people who were testifying, when they were asked a question like, what does jihad mean, would turn and say, I'm not competent to speak to that. And they'd look over at the, I don't mean to look at you, Bob, but they'd look over at the corner of the room where this homicidal maniac was stationed throughout our trial, and they'd say, I couldn't answer that, you'd have to speak to somebody like him, and meaning the blind sheikh. And what you come away with that from that with is this sense that even among Islamic moderates who are authentically moderate people, the battle we have is that they find somebody like the blind sheikh, because of his educational accomplishments and because of the stature that he has in the world of doctrine, they find him to be a persuasive, authoritative figure with respect to key parts of doctrine that they don't feel themselves competent to address. The juxtaposition, which is disturbing, is that on the courthouse steps, the Justice Department, when we're doing press conferences or whatever public type statements we would be doing, we would be saying one thing about Islam, religion of peace. I think Condi Rice promoted it to religion of love and peace at the last iftar dinner that the State Department holds every year now. But those are the sorts of things that you can do for public consumption if you're doing press conferences and public statements. Inside the courtroom, there are a lot of downsides to using the criminal justice system to deal with terrorism, but there's one thing that's absolutely true, and that is that if you're going to try to get people to convict people who are on trial for serious crimes, you have to give them a straight story about what happened and a rational reason why it happened. And there was no, in the four corners of the trial, there was no political correctness. And what the jurors learned and what the jurors saw is that this wave of terrorism that we were already dealing with was generated by a solid ideology, and that the blind sheikh was a very important person in it, and that it was not a fringe. Unfortunately, that is a lesson that was learned in that courtroom 12 years ago, but it has not, for whatever reason, managed to carry itself outside the courtroom to the point where it grabs the majority of people like I think it has to. Before taking some questions, let me just deal with what I think my most important contribution to this could be, and that is this thought that you can turn your national security problems into legal problems. I get asked all the time, by virtue of having done the case, to be on panels or to give speeches about national security around the country. And what that ends up meaning most of the time is that you're speaking in a legal forum. I mean, we're having this meeting today at a law firm. Most of the places where I speak are either law schools or bar association-oriented institutions. But that is, for the most part, where the dialogue about our national security is taking place, which should convey to you something about how important the legal aspects have become. Too important, I think, for my taste. The topic of most of those forums tends to be, does the criminal justice system work for terrorism? And when it's asked in those forums, what people tend to mean is very specific. You're dealing with people who are either themselves legal elites or wannabe legal elites or training to be lawyers, And when they hear, does the criminal justice system work against terrorism, what they mean is, can we provide enough due process that we can give trials to people who we accuse of terrorist offenses, give them the modicum of due process that we would require for an outcome in our criminal justice system to have integrity, and hold our head up about the results? And if that is where you're coming from, if that is what the question is, I don't think that there's any doubt about what the answer to that is. We know that we can give adequate terrorist trials in the criminal justice system because we've done it before. We've done it repeatedly. We had about six major and three less substantial terrorism trials during the 1980s, when running through the attacks that occurred between 1993 and 9/11. I'm not going to run through all of them, but the country was attacked about once a year between 1993 and 9/11, from the original World Trade Center attack through, you know, COBAR, the embassies, the coal, et cetera, right up to 9/11. Everybody who was accused or indicted and brought into the criminal justice system, and the criminal justice system was the only game in town during the 1990s, everyone who was brought into the system was convicted. I mean, you can't do better than that. We batted 1,000. And every court of appeals that has scrutinized those cases say they were models of due process. They even say the prosecutors did a good job, which is, you know, something the Court of Appeals never did. But they laud the defense lawyers, they laud the performance of the judges and the Justice Department as well. So I think if the question is, can we give them fair trials, there's no question we can give them fair trials. But the question for the country, outside the legal elites, when you are asked, does the criminal justice system work for terrorism, is not about whether we can give fair trials. It's about whether, as a national security strategy, prosecution in the criminal justice system works, particularly when, as was the case throughout the 1990s, it is not only the point of the spear, it's virtually the whole spear. I mean, basically, that's what we did with terrorists in the 90s. And sadly, I must say that the jury is in on that question as well, because in those nine trials that I talk about, between 93 and 9/11, when the consensus of experts is that, you know, whether you think the number of people in Al-Qaeda, let's just take Al-Qaeda, is on the low end or the high end, everybody agrees that it was getting bigger through those 8 years, whether it was in the thousands or the tens of thousands, depending on what your take is on what the tentacles are and what affiliate means and all that sort of stuff. As the enemy is getting bigger, and as the attacks are getting progressively more audacious over an eight-year period, with the country being hit again and again, we managed to take out exactly 29 terrorists. 29. And for the most part, the people that we neutralized, the people that we managed to take out, were the lowest of the low, but for a handful of exceptions, like the Blind Sheikh and Ramzi Youssef and, you know, two or three others. We're talking about the lowest ranking, most easily replaceable terrorists in this vast network. The next time somebody tells you the criminal justice system works for terrorism as a national security strategy, you might want to remind them about Osama bin Laden himself. Osama bin Laden was indicted by the United States in June of 1998. That's 2 months before the embassy bombings, it's before the coal, and it's before 9/11. It sounds trite, and I've said this again and again, but adding new counts to the indictment doesn't seem to deter him much, and has never deterred him much. The fact remains, and I think this by now should be taken as a fact, the only sensible counterterrorism strategy, the only sensible counterterrorism strategy is a holistic one, a comprehensive one that brings to bear all of the tools of government.
David, could you put your phone on mute?
If we want to make an impact, it has to be, I think, a recognition of the role of the ideology is important. But just in terms of on-the-ground tools against terrorism, you've got to bring the military to bear. You've got to bring your intelligence services actively in covert operations to bear. You have to have Treasury tracking of terrorist finance, not just put the laws on the books like we did in the 90s, actually use them to try to dry up the funding. And in that kind of a structure, the Justice Department's role is not going to be unimportant, but it's going to be subordinate. If we're in a national security strategy where prosecution is in the forefront of what our response is, that is a disastrous strategy, because there is simply a finite limit to what the justice system can do in terms of bringing people to heel, including getting its hands on the people who we need to prosecute. So why don't I stop there and take whatever questions you'd like. But thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Andy. I'm Daniel Pipes, for your compelling testimony from the front line. I might note that we're grateful to Olshan for hosting us, but this is not a legal event. It is by coincidence as a law firm. Let me start by mentioning that by coincidence, my column this week, which I just sent out, is on the topic of the number of Islamists. Is it a tiny minority or not? And in particular, I was quoted, or I made a statement on screen in the Obsession film, which is everywhere now, 28 million copies, in which I said 10 to 15% of Muslims are Islamists. And I've been lambasted repeatedly the last month for that. Mm-hmm. So I decided to go back to the drawing board and look. And I think the column shows that it's a reasonable number. But what is so particularly interesting about it is how difficult it is to define. And let me give you one example. The Gallup poll did a huge survey of 50,000 Muslims in 10 countries, and it ranked the Muslims in part by how they looked at 9/11. And those who said that it was a completely justified attack were 7% number, and those who said it was completely justified or somewhat justified totaled 13.5%, and those who said it was completely justified, somewhat justified, or maybe justified came to 33%. 5%. So which number are you going to pick? Do we have 7% Islamists, 13% Islamists, or 33% Islamists? It's a difficult problem of perception. In any case, to get back to your topic, I too railed in the 1990s against the dependence on the legal system. And one of, I think, the great virtues of 9/11, or the silver linings of 9/11, was that right away that evening, President Bush got on television and to the nation declared this a war on terror, not a police action against terror, but a war on terror. And yet, as you point out, we've really never quite gone to that, and we're still relying too much on the judiciary. Could you explain what your strategy would be? What would you like us to do?
From a legal standpoint, the machinery that we would need to do what I would like to do is in place. I talk in the book about the fact that the legal arsenal that we had to prosecute terrorists in 1993 was appallingly bad. For example, the law, if you carried out a conspiracy to bomb a building, like the World Trade Center, even if what you were hoping to do was murder tens of thousands of people, if you were thwarted in the conspiracy, that is, if you didn't actually carry out the bombing, you just had a plot like we had on the UN and the Lincoln and Holland tunnels, there was no federal bombing conspiracy statute. So you had to bring that under the catch-all federal conspiracy statute, which is the same one you would use in a fraud case. That has a penalty of 0 to 5 years. So that was what we were confronting, and actually the reason we used seditious conspiracy was mainly not only because it pointed directly at what had occurred, but it upped the potential sentence by about 20 years. In 1996, I've been very critical of the Clinton administration in a variety of ways. Let me tell you something very good that they did. In 1996, there was a radical, I probably use a different word, total overhaul of the anti-terrorism laws, to the point where we actually wrote statutes which not only allowed us to do a bunch of investigative things that you need to be able to do to investigate terrorism, but new crimes were written which directly match up with the sort of terrorist activity that we had become familiar with beginning in the late 80s. So there's no way a prosecutor could tell you that we don't have enough in our legal arsenal now to bring people to heel who are brought into the system. We do. Getting them into the system is another problem, but have it once you have them in the system, you can prosecute them with what we have. What I think people need to realize is that for the most part, we are not going to be able to bring people into the system and prosecute them. And most of the terrorist threat as it exists overseas, and that is a lot of the threat, are not people that we are going to want to bring into our regular justice system. It's too burdensome. It's too difficult to get people prosecuted, and most importantly, you have to compromise too much sensitive intelligence in order to bring these trials to a proper ending, a just ending. A couple of things I think we have to do. Number one, I would set up a national security court so that we could have trials that provided an adequate amount of due process so that they would stand up in terms of the integrity we want to attach to the results, but not provide all of the intelligence that you are required to provide in the criminal justice system. And I think in a nod to our allies, it really doesn't matter, you know, we've tried and we're currently trying this military commission system. It really doesn't matter if we think the military commission system is adequate under our Constitution. The fact is that we need to make some accommodations to our allies because they are not going to extradite people to a system that is unilaterally a military show. Even if we have a history of it and we can justify it under our Constitution, the fact is in the places where terrorists are going to be operating outside the United States, those countries are not going to send, even if we close Gitmo tomorrow, which everybody seems to want to do, if we had a system that was a military system that didn't have a judicial component, that is independent judges presiding over the cases, our allies and the other countries that we have to work with are not going to extradite terrorists into a system like that. And if you don't provide a system that they'll extradite people to, you're essentially outsourcing your national security to people who have a lot less interest in it than you do. So I think we have to set up a court system that becomes expert in these issues, not only terrorism trials, but these issues of surveillance and investigation and interrogation and all the things that we've had to deal with since 9/11. We also have to have an adult understanding of what the criminal justice system is capable of doing and what we're asking it to do. You know, there's been a lot of talk since 9/11 about changing the paradigm. You know, we've gone from a prosecution paradigm to a prevention paradigm. Investigations are no longer as important as intelligence. And I think people hear that and they say, well, yeah, sure, that makes sense. It's much better to stop the attack from happening than content yourself with whoever it is you may be able to prosecute afterwards. I've lost my train of thought. I apologize. I want to take another question if you would.
Let me note that Mr. McCarthy's book is available here, gentlemen, from the bookstore, if you'd like to purchase it.
I'm sorry, can I? I caught myself, and I'll get to you in a second. I apologize for going blank there for a second. If you're going to be in a prevention paradigm, what that necessarily means is you're asking the prosecutors and the agents to interrupt terrorist events at an earlier point in time where your evidence is not going to be as good. It's going to be ambiguous. I mean, imagine somebody arrested Mohammed Atta on September 10th. Think about what the state of our knowledge was about him at that point in time, which was almost nil. think about what the, you know, the New York Times would have said if you had brought him in and said, you know, we think he's about to lead a plot to drive airliners into four major targets, including the World Trade Center. Nobody would have believed it. It's easy to do, in a sense, it's easy to do the kinds of cases that we did in the 90s. And I'm not saying that they're easy cases, but the public can get behind them, because when you prosecute people after great catastrophes, there's a burning desire in the society that people get brought to justice. What we're now asking our agents and prosecutors to do is interrupt things at a very early stage, at a point in time where evidence may be ambiguous and it may be difficult to tell who's an innocent bystander versus who is an active terrorist. And what that necessarily means is we're not going to bat 1,000 anymore. And I don't think you can have the same level of expectations leveled at the Justice Department under that scenario as you did in the 90s.
Thank you. Could you keep your questions short and to the point?
Since you mentioned that part of the consideration is how well our system, you know, is accepted by allies, can you say a word about what France does? I understand that they're supposed to be somewhat competent in terms of anti-terrorism and in their approach. And if the British have done the IRA or whatnot, that perhaps we can learn for, in the sense that if it both works, then it would be palatable to them.
One thing I think we absolutely have to do that these other systems do is administrative detention. Following the 9/11 attacks, there's been a lot of criticism of the way that was handled. I was one of the people helping to run the command post after 9/11, and we ended up using the immigration laws to lock people up, and using this device called the material witness warrant, where you're grabbing someone on the ostensible justification that you want him to be a cooperative witness, when in fact what we were looking for was a device to grab people and hold them till we could figure out whether they were really terrorists or whether they were innocent people. If you want to stop attacks from happening, I think you have to have a mechanism, as these other countries do, to be able to go into a court and be able to detain somebody for some reasonable period of time without having to bring charges. In our system, basically, you have to have proof beyond the reasonable, well, I'm sorry, you have to have proof at a probable cause level that somebody is guilty of an offense before you can detain them. And when we have that level of proof, it's often too late. You know, that's the big problem I think we have with our surveillance laws. We had a big debate in the country for about a couple of years about FISA reform, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And it was prompted by the fact that the president had done a warrantless wiretapping after 9/11. I've always thought that the big problem, and the administration didn't explain this well at all, but the big problem with the surveillance court is that in order to get a warrant from a judge to conduct surveillance, you have to go in and show probable cause that somebody is an agent of a foreign power, which can include a terrorist organization. We know from our intelligence that, you know, new terrorist organizations are arising all the time. And it happened with Massawi, it's happened in connection with others. It often happens that we don't have that kind of proof about somebody who is dangerous. The Fourth Amendment does not require probable cause in every situation where you do a search, and it certainly does not, in the national security framework, require a probable cause showing to a court before you can conduct surveillance. So I think we have to ratchet down our courtroom standards. Probable cause is basically a courtroom standard. It's a standard that applies in criminal cases when you want to conduct a search of somebody who you suspect of a crime. It's perfectly appropriate under those circumstances, but it's not something that can comfortably be imported into national security.
So brief, the challenge is to adjust the judicial system to a wartime
right
situation. Judy?
I'm shaking. I'm really shaking like a leaf. And I'm going to tell you something. It's not a question, but maybe if I'm coming clean after since June of 2001. In the early morning, late June 2001, my girlfriend was riding her bicycle from 110 Bleecker Street to Stuyvesant, where she teaches art. On the way, she passed the World Trade Center. And as she was riding her bike, and she was very close, she saw two people, I believe it's two people, they were doing, they were surveying. And they were surveying the whole area, and they were surveying the World Trade Center. And she looked at them, and they looked at her, and she looked, they looked like daggers. And she even saw the people. And she didn't know what to do. And she left, but she saw them. And then she conferred with somebody else who also saw people either that day or the day before. They didn't know what to do with this. And they still are talking about it today. We're talking about it in our circles, but we didn't know where to go or what to do. Now, I don't know if that would do anybody any good or not, but I'm just saying it now.
So what do citizens do with information?
Well, just, I'm not that it'll make you feel any better, but back at that point in time, you know, the government didn't exactly know what to do with that information either. I don't want to go on too long about the wall, but you've all heard about the wall that the Justice Department, based on a number of court decisions, raised up between its national security investigators and its criminal investigators, so the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. And as strongly as you obviously feel about the one incident that you're talking about, we actually had an incident where an FBI agent on the national security side of the government was aware of the fact that Khaled al-Nahar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, two of the 9/11 hijackers, were in the country, and he wanted to try to locate them. So he asked the FBI headquarters if he could get assistance from the criminal division of the FBI to help locate these two guys. This was about a month before 9/11, and he was told no, because that would be a violation of the forbidden intermingling between the national security investigators and the criminal investigators. You should be relieved to know that things are much better now. Right after 9/11 happened, the walls came down. So what I would advise anyone who sees something suspicious is that they should report it to the FBI.
Because they were thinking, should the FBI will not believe us at the time. Well, obviously, it's true.
Well, it depends on, you know, the FBI is a big organization, and some people would believe it and run with it, and other people would rather not be bothered.
Can you talk about sort of the money trail or financial forensics, you know, how Al-Qaeda and, you know,
various other terrorist organizations might be using our financial system, and, you know, how they're using it and how that impacts our national security. Yeah, that's a great question. A number of people have started to do work on Sharia compliant finance, which is the latest wave of this. Frank Gaffney, I'm thinking of in particular.
Hope Winters.
I'm sorry?
Hope Winters.
Oh. Are you? Oh, hi, how are you? I'm sorry. But I think that aspect is something that needs to be looked at very carefully, because what we're now seeing is American financial institutions are setting up these Sharia-compliant financial instruments. And in order, I mean, the reason for Sharia compliance is that interest is against Islamic law. So they have to figure out a way to structure financial transactions so that you can do something with the interest to make believe that it's not really interest. And one of the things that they do in order to purge these tranches of money so that they are Sharia compliant is that they have to purge what would otherwise be interest. And one way that that is often done is it is redirected to what these ostensible Islamic charities under the auspices of zakat, which is the Islamic obligation of charitable giving. The problem is the advisors of a lot of these American financial institutions that they've brought in for Sharia compliance purposes are radical clerics. And the charities that they are diverting things to are, you know, the same charitable fronts that we've been seeing for years and years. And it becomes, if we if we recognize Sharia finance in our law, I think we do two things that are disastrous. Number one, we legitimize within American law a body of law that at bottom is committed to the destruction of the West. That's just the way it is. And secondly, before we get to that point, we actually help them divert funding from legitimate institutions to people who mean us harm. So if I had one, I mean, we need to do a lot of things on the finance end, including using it for intelligence purposes, not just drying up the swamps. You would think in government, if you have an opportunity to arrest someone, the first impulse people have is, let's arrest them and have a press conference, you know? And you would think with a lot of the financial tracking, what they would want to do is seize thousands and thousands of dollars and then have a press conference to show how good we are at seizing thousands of dollars. I think one of the good things is they haven't done a lot of that. They've done some of that, but they haven't done a lot of it. You know from the investigations that were done after 9/11 that our sources of intelligence are terrible in the parts of the world where we need intelligence the most. And one way I think that we're trying to make up for that intelligence deficit is instead of leaping in and trying to seize the money, following where it goes so that we're able to map these organizations and figure out who the players are. It's the sort of thing I think you have to do when you don't have real on-the-ground sources.
Well, one of the things I remember everybody talking about is how they were short selling before 9/11.
Right.
They would make all this money after.
And I was right where the conspiracy was, and no one let me in on it. I'm really annoyed about that. I don't think so. I don't have any reason to think it's true.
Did you need to show that radical Islam is widespread in your case, or is it just another thing you found out?
We didn't need to show it to win the case, but you couldn't prove the case without incidentally showing it to be true. What this gets to is really the common sense of jurors, and you know why people, Buckley said he'd rather be governed by the first however many names in the phone book than the faculty of Harvard Law School. It's why it's good to have jury trials. I mean, one of the things that you pick up along the way is if people had thought the Sheikh was a fringe figure, a lot of our case would have been very iffy. But because we were able to convey the idea that he was an authoritative figure and somebody to be very nervous and worried about, we were able to convict him not only on some of the bombing charges, but we convicted him on three different charges of solicitation to acts of violence. And most of those were embedded in sermons. So the issue for the jury is, you know, basically, do we need to take this guy seriously or not, or is he just a crackpot? And a lot of our evidence, I think, was designed to show that he was a very influential person. And because of the way he was treated by those moderate Muslims who I mentioned before, I think that became pretty obvious to common sense people who had to make a decision.
Could you say a word or two about Gordon Cromberg, who in some sense is your successor and has been under attack? For his talking about radical Islam in the courtroom. He's a prosecutor in the Washington, D.C. area.
You'll be shocked to learn I'm a Gordon fan. I think he's a very aggressive prosecutor. I think, you know, frankly, if we had another 9/11 style attack, there'd be a lot of people marched up to Capitol Hill and asked why they weren't as aggressive as Gordon Cromberg was. But until we have such an attack, the usual suspects are going to attack him for the very aggressiveness that we say we expect out of our prosecutors. Monday morning quarterbacking is always easy. I think he's done a couple of things that gave his critics some ammunition to attack him. Which you are apt to do in these cases. You know, the problem with prosecuting cases, particularly difficult ones, is that you end up saying a lot of things in real time that if you had more time to think about them, you'd probably phrase them differently. So, you know, he's given them some fodder to attack him with, but I think that's a very, very minor point in the greater scheme of things. He's been, you know, look, he's got a track record where he's investigated and convicted some very dangerous people. Courts of appeals have looked at those cases and scrubbed them upside down and backwards, and they've held up. And frankly, this latest brouhaha that he's involved in with Al Arian, I think is absolutely outrageous. There's no every citizen in the United States. Forget about you know, people from Palestinian Islamic Jihad who are here to, you know, conduct terrorist operations. Every citizen of the United States has an obligation to answer questions in the grand jury unless you have a privilege not to. Al Arian has no privilege not to share with the grand jury what it is that he knows about terrorism. His claim that he was promised that he would never have to testify in the grand jury has been rejected by three different higher federal courts. And it's just, I mean, to me, it's just, I prosecuted people in the mafia before I was a terrorism prosecutor. It was a commonplace that after people pled guilty, you would throw them in the grand jury and try to find out what else they knew. And if they didn't talk, they ended up being held in contempt. But the issue, just for the people who aren't lawyers, once you've been convicted, and once you've been immunized by the government, they give you an immunity order. What that means is that they can't prosecute you on the basis of what you tell them. So therefore, you no longer have a Fifth Amendment privilege not to testify. And once that happens, you're expected to, you know, testify in the grand jury if you get called there. We would expect that of any citizen in the United States. So the thought that we wouldn't, under circumstances where we're under a terrorist threat, that we would even think for 2 seconds that we wouldn't hold convicted terrorists to that obligation, to me, is just nuts. And it's, again, the fact that he's got so many people supporting him. I mean, can you imagine? He had a guy who was a former United States senator address a meeting and suggest that you put pressure on Gordon not only by criticizing him in the media, but also harassing his family, including, you know, demonstrating where his children go to school, which I must say, you know, we dealt with some bad stuff in the 90s. I never had to deal with anything like that. So
who was the senator?
You know, I forget the guy's name. He was at one Gravel, point, from Alaska?
Mike Gravel
from Alaska, you know, who lobbied at one point to try to be McGovern's vice president before he wisely chose Thomas Eagleton, I guess.
One or two more questions, please.
Can you have the shipbuilder training that, and use some of the terminology in an excellent book? The conveyor belt that produced the battalions of Islam is producing capable operatives in the United States today. So, there are training camps just all over the country. And how do we address that problem? Can't something like be done to stop that? I know we have to, like, watch them, but we're training them. And New York may be prepared for such people as paramilitaries and stuff, but the rest of the country.
This is actually more frightening than you even suspect. I saw this morning in something I got from Steve Emerson's shop that there was a story in the Washington Post that a judge in a federal district court in Washington is considering potentially releasing the Uyghur enemy combatants into the United States. These are ethnically Chinese Muslims who were captured by the U.S. military after our operations began in Afghanistan after 9/11. A couple of months ago, right after the Boumediene case, which is the case where the Supreme Court decided that the enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay had constitutional habeas corpus rights, or the right to come into federal court and challenge their detention, Shortly after that, a panel of the Federal Court of Appeals in D.C. Reversed, or at least presumed to reverse, the president's and the military's determination that the Uyghurs were enemy combatants, and basically told the government to come back with a better case for why they're enemy combatants. Now, here I think the fault lies with the military in many ways here, and this goes back to what I was saying before about, you know, not dealing with ideology. The military acknowledges and proved to the court that the Uyghurs were actually trained in jihadist al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But the military took the position that these guys are no longer a threat to the United States because their beef is with the Chinese, not with us. Now, anybody who understands even a little bit of the basics of the ideology that we're dealing with understands that the people who are trained in those camps and the ideology that is taught in those camps is that the world is divided up between Dar al-Harb and Dar al-Islam, the world of the Muslims and the realm of war. They're not interested in the Westphalia nation-state system. And that's not just an al-Qaeda position. You know, the Ayatollah Khomeini himself famously said that you know, he didn't give a damn about this land, meaning Iran. What he was interested in leading was a revolutionary movement to establish the Islamic State worldwide. So because we don't care about ideology, we you know, do, in my view, idiotic things like figure that you can figure that we have these Muslim radicals and they're only interested in going after the Chinese, not after the United States. So, okay, it's safe to let them in the United States, in the United States, notwithstanding that they've been trained in jihadist camps. And this is a long way, winded way of coming back to your point, which is we should be saying, based on all of the experience we have, whether it's 93 or the 98 attacks or the Cole or everything we know, is that where you have jihadist training, where you have paramilitary training, you end up with terrorist attacks. And if we haven't gotten to the point where we can say, just because these guys have been trained in al-Qaeda camps in Pakistan and Afghanistan, that's reason enough to keep them out of our country, that means we're not taking the threat seriously and we don't understand it at this point.
If I might shift gears for a second. Okay, hope, quick.
I wonder if you could talk to it, and I don't know if you're working on the Hill. I know you're on the Hill from time to time.
Not without my helmet.
To Tom Tancredo. That jihad protection bill,
I don't remember that one.
Because it kind of speaks to what you were just saying about these terrorist cells and maybe a little bit of ray of hope, which is that his bill, and of course it's
the Sharia recognition thing,
it's
right?
A little bit of political well building in Capitol Hill. Says that anyone who subscribes to or advocates Sharia, which of course is a problem here, should be deported. And France is actually doing this already. So
I barely remember the outlines of Tancredo's bill, but to the extent that what he's arguing is that we have to avoid any recognition of Sharia in our law and not treat it as American law.
No, he's going beyond that, saying anyone who wants Sharia to be applied should not be let in the country or even should be expelled.
Well, I do think that we need to do a lot more with our immigration laws along those lines. I mean, whenever I talk about that, you know, people start screaming, you know, McCarthyism, and they're not talking about me. The McCarran Act and all that jazz. But, you know, under our Constitution, we do not have to let we're allowed to take attitudes into account. We don't have to pretend that everybody outside the United States has First Amendment rights. We don't have to pretend that they have the right to believe they obviously do have the right to believe whatever they want. But if you advocate anti-American views, we can keep you out of the country. It's actually one of the less controversial reasons for keeping you out of the country. Yeah.
So we've now heard about the new McCarthyism.
Right.
I'd like to switch topics a bit. You have an article in, I think, the September issue of Commentary about libel tourism, which is libel tourism, which, as some of you may know, is a reference to the particularly the British instance of permitting plaintiffs to sue American, New York State authors for 23 books that were sold in Britain. May I make the counterpoint that that's yesterday's problem, that it is something the British political system is beginning to address, and really the more important problem for the future of those of us who speak about these questions is the Jordanian gambit. The Jordanian prosecutor a few months ago indicted Geert Wilders, the Dutch politician who created the film Fitna, on criminal charges for insulting the prophet. Now you might laugh at that and say, well, Geert Wilders, a Dutch politician, need not go to Jordan. But the Jordanians are integrated into the European Euro-Mediterranean system and can claim extradition rights. And Wilders is affected by this. He tells us that he needs to get a letter before he goes to a foreign country and get assurance that he's not going to be extradited. Isn't that something a lot more dangerous than libel tourism? Isn't that something that affects potentially all of us, that can constrict us and really affect our lives more than some billionaire Saudi bringing some court case in Britain?
Well, I wouldn't minimize yet the danger of libel tourism. I do think the British system is starting to address it, but they haven't addressed it fully yet. And frankly, you know, what they're giving people is legal remedies that they can raise in court. And the problem for journalists and publishers who are on a much more shoestring type budget than somebody like Khaled bin Mahfouz, who is one of the richest men in the world, is that just the fact of being sued and the interim effect of such a lawsuit discourages people from not only doing these investigations and writing important information, but having it see the light of day. And I don't think that hasn't been adequately addressed. I do agree with Daniel that the problem that he sketches out is at least equally as frightening, if not more frightening. And again, it goes to the acceptance of Sharia and the universalizing of Sharia. It's not just a Jordanian problem. I've heard of prominent commentators who are now, I don't want to mention their names because I don't know that this is public, but we have had people who have written about Islamofascism who have been investigated and are being investigated for hate speech in various parts of the world. And the idea is to get them indicted for whether it's you know, statutes that recognize Islamophobia, statutes that call what we would regard perhaps as simple truth-speaking statements as hate speech, and then you know, filing arrest warrants which get picked up by Interpol, which is the international police service that we encounter as we traverse from country to country. We now have commentators who've written on Islam and Islamofascism who are afraid to travel for fear not only that they'll be arrested in a place like Jordan, but they'll be arrested in a place like Japan. So this is a very serious problem. You know, to the extent that Sharia becomes more and more accepted, and to the extent that speech suppression as a strategy becomes something that is less alarming to the world outside the United States, I think we're going to see some severe problems to be extremely frightened about. And it's not just the prospect of prosecution overseas, it's the inability of people in the United States to travel outside the United States, and not just Americans, obviously.
Thank you. Well, we've reached 1:30. We want to
take one more.
Yeah. I have a corollary to that.
Quickly.
I asked one of my patients, that's a Muslim, an Egyptian-American woman, a Muslim born here, why the moderate Arabs don't decry terrorism in this country. And I was very surprised to hear. She said, we're afraid of our own mullahs here.
Right.
Blows my mind. I mean, you know, we're helping.
Well, one more brief war story. We were way behind. I mentioned before that we had hundreds of hours of tapes. We were way behind in our obligation to get finalized tapes to the defense, you know, final versions of conversations. And there wasn't as much of the usual security concern as there is for people who work for the government with respect to these tapes, because the tapes themselves had already been turned over to the defense. This wasn't like asking somebody to monitor an intelligence wire. This was simply translate tapes that the defense already had. So I had a lower level of worry about security considerations, and therefore an easy ability to hire some people. And I brought three different people in to ask them if they would help us with the translation of these tapes. And they were all Muslim Americans from New York. Once I had to tell them that I couldn't promise that their name would never emerge as people who had helped the government, they all said no. And I was pretty sure that I could probably protect them, but you can't promise them something that's not in your power to deliver. And it was interesting talking to them, because it wasn't so much that they were afraid of violence, although I'm sure there was some of that. What they were worried about is that their families would be ostracized in the community. And these were, you know, ostensibly moderate communities, but because of the people who were in charge of the mosque, or, you know, the higher, who were deemed to be the Muslim higher ups in the community, they were really concerned about their families being ostracized. That's in New York. And I think the problem that you talk about is repeated tenfold outside.
Well, again, thank you so much, Ed.
Thank you.